pain. I'm hurting no more. Come on and try me. You started this war. Won't bite you, baby. No ifs or maybes. I'm finished. I'm through. I'm over and done with you. I tell you, I'm feeling no pain. Right down to the bone. You done your damage. Now leave me alone. I'm sick and tired. Baby, I'm buying. I'm finished. I'm through. I'm over and done.
I picked it for the title, Feeling No Pain. Decided I'd make that our solidarity song. That's a feature G instituted at the start of the 8 o'clock hour every night, every weeknight. She does a song and a shout out to all of the first responders and healthcare workers and everybody who's getting us through this. So that's the Del Satins, Columbia Records, 1963. Didn't chart. Dion DiMucci co-wrote it. And the Del Satins were nothing if not a white New York doo-wop group, but they had a ton of members over the years. Probably the most famous was Johnny Maestro of the Crests and the Brooklyn Bridge, but they did a lot of backup. In fact, when Dion decided to replace the Belmonts, he chose them, and so they were on Run Around Sue and the Wanderer and Ruby Baby and Donna the Primadonna and all that stuff, and they're also heard on Ernie Maresca's Shout Shout Knock Yourself Out on Seville. They did a lot of stuff for Alan Freed. They wound up, like I say, on Columbia for that record with Feeling No Pain. There were regulars on Clay Cole, who was the kind of TV dance king in New York City. And so where's the Chicago connection? I have one for this, actually. And that's their name, the Del Satins. They idolized the Dells. So Del from Del Satins was the Dells. And, of course, you can imagine Satins came from Connecticut's Five Satins of In the Still of the Night fame. So you know we'll play some Dells and some Five Satins tonight, no doubt about that. All right, I've been looking forward to this, and I thought it was perfect to have Captain Trahan back on, because Independence Day is tomorrow, and he had a heck of a career as an Air Force officer, and he's a Vietnam vet, but also because I love talking about the airlines, and he flew for Delta for over 30 years, retired 32 years in as a captain in 2002, so Captain Trahan, welcome.
Again, I've been looking forward to this.
Me too. Thank you for the books. I read the Delta One first, of course, and just you couldn't pry me away from that book. I loved every page of it. And what was most interesting to me is I decided I'd read the Air Force years next, and I have absolutely no connection to the Air Force, and I thought, I wonder if I'll like this. And early on, it just captivated me. So you're a great writer.
Well, thank you. Well, I appreciate that. I was wondering what direction this would go tonight, because you've got so much to choose from reading those books.
Well, I do, and I have not finished the third one yet, but of course, this is a wonderful trilogy, but The Gift, The Beginning, the Air Force years and the Delta years, but you've written so much more, like Delta Deja Vu, and it's all on Amazon.com, so that's just terrific. Are you still writing?
No, not a whole lot lately. I'm just kind of... We've got our granddaughter and our great granddaughters living with us right now, so I'm soccer mom now.
Oh, that's great!
Having a good time with them. But I haven't done much writing lately. But
they're all
there. Yeah, I'm glad you got the books. I'm glad you enjoyed them, Ronnie.
Oh, I did, and you know, like you probably were after the fact, I was kind of crushed when you decided you'd go transport instead of fighter, but, you know, you certainly got a workout. I wouldn't call it a fighter jet, but what you did with Spooky was utterly amazing.
Well, it's funny how things work out, Raleigh. You know, I was really torn between going to fighters and transports, and I knew that I wanted to see the world. And I made the choice, and believe it or not, I regretted it, because fighters, the Air Force was the only place in the world you could fly those kind of airplanes, you know, and I passed up that opportunity. Yeah. But it led me, since I had to go to war anyway, and I don't like, you know, I didn't relish the thought of killing people, but since I had to go to war, and I got the perfect mission for me, which was close air support, so that any battle I got into, I was fighting. Me and my crew were fighting off people who were attacking our troops or our allies. So it was the perfect mission for me. And I wouldn't have felt that way in a fighter. It would have been a little different. So,
right.
And things all worked out.
Had you chosen fighter, you would not have been given that close air support mission, right?
Well, yeah, I probably would have, but it would have been different. Fighters did fly close air support, but they weren't capable of hanging around with those guys all night if they needed them. You know, they'd come in and drop their bombs or strafe, and they were out of there. And
right.
But we were able to babysit them all night if we had to.
Well, and you, I could tell from the book, you really had relationships with these people. I mean, this was up close and personal. The whole theory of Spooky, and I'm gonna make you briefly tell us that again if somebody missed your last two appearances, but the whole theory of Spooky is absolutely ingenious. In some way, it turns fixed wings into choppers as far as their ability to hover.
Well, basically, yes. The choppers, of course, would fire out the side. They could fire any direction, but normally fixed-wing aircraft fired out the front because that's the way they did it forever. And somebody came up with the idea of getting an old transport airplane, and they picked the C-47, which civilians know as the DC-3, which was built by Douglas in the 30s. And it was the oldest airplane in Air Force inventory, but they decided in 1965 that there was a desperate need for a close air support that would be able to go out to outposts and units that were on the ground out there and provide close air support at night for them and be able to stay there and provide a lot of firepower. So they picked the DC-3 because they could put three machine guns on it. We had three 7.62 minigun machine guns. They fired 6,000 rounds a minute, and we could, because the airplane was a transport, we could carry 21,000 rounds of ammunition, and that weighs a lot. And we also carried 48 flares on parachutes, so we could go set up just a night. We'd be on night patrol and flying around hot areas, and anybody got in trouble, they would call us, and we'd come in and provide close air support. And yes, it was quite intimate. I mean, sometimes one night the outpost was being overrun, and the guy asked me to put the fire on the camp, so I had to shoot right on top of them, and they were all bunkered in. And he said there were probably a couple of hundred of them up there coming through there, and after about 10 seconds of firing, he said, "You can cease fire, Spooky. It's quiet up there now." So, yeah, it got intimate.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. And, of course, Vietnam is such a jumble of emotions, and we've talked about how you and everybody else felt when they got back to America and were literally spat upon. But some of my buddies who had been in Nam, one of the things that they disliked the most was the way the war ended. They felt that was not a fitting thing to do. Of course, you were already flying for Delta at that time, but how did you feel when you heard the news?
I was, but I was still invested in the war. You know, In fact, there were times when, after I came home, that I got guilty, that I didn't think about those guys over there every day, because I know that, you know, we were forgotten a lot when we were there. But it was very, very unsatisfying the way it ended. But the whole thing was fought so much politically rather than militarily that I expected something like that. I'm
really
disappointed for the Vietnamese people, you know, that we lost their country to the Chinese, to the communists. I mean, not the Chinese.
Right. Well, ultimately,
well,
maybe,
yeah,
maybe
they're in
that's
the news
not so,
today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
so far off. Of
right.
course, your Delta years were most fascinating to me because you spanned the time coming in when we still had the CAB aborting routes and things were very regulated to absolutely the Wild West, as it were, with deregulation.
Yes.
How did that change for you?
Oh, well, do you know who Frank Lorenzo was?
I was.
I guess he's still around.
I hate Frank Lorenzo. I don't know him, but I'll tell you why I say that. I say that because of Al Feldman killing himself in his El Segundo office in 1981. And that was a large result of Lorenzo taking off over Continental. And, you know, and Texas Air. And Continental, of course, was so interesting because it had started out as a classy airline. Then it had gone into the low price thing in the 50s. And then it came back as, like, literally the classiest carrier, the best meals and all that. And here comes Lorenzo. And, oh, my dear God. Now, I hope he isn't your best friend or anything.
No, I was just going to say, Continental was the proud bird with the golden tail back in those days.
Yes.
And we loved them at Delta. In fact, we thought if we ever merged that we would hope we would merge with Continental.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, Frank got them first. And he was the one that started the first low-cost airlines. And
right.
He really changed. He changed the industry for us. I can't go too deeply into it, but it messed us up for a long time. I didn't care for him either, but, you know, good for him. He got his.
Well, and so, he decimated Eastern, too, while we're at it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I understand the good points and all that, but overall, when Al decided after Robert Six left that he's going to just eat it rather than deal with Lorenzo, I just thought that was a very sad moment all the way around.
Very much so. Very much so.
You know, and I mentioned before, I'm no economist, God knows, but I don't understand the financial model because, of course, back in the Juan Trip days, it was all about how much mail you flew. You were government contractors.
And, yeah, they were subsidized with the mail.
Sure.
The passengers weren't that important. So
right.
later on, the airlines had to subsidize with cargo. They would carry a lot of cargo overseas if they did, their passenger load wasn't enough. But
yes.
the thing was, we all kind of had our roots, and then after deregulation, it was a fight. It was a mud fight, you know, and it affected just about everything we did. I remember in the early 70s when I first started flying, and when Lorenzo came in, somebody said there someday there would be only four major airlines. And I think if you start counting them today, there's probably about four.
Right.
If you think about it, yeah. And there were dozens back in the day.
Oh, there were so many just wonderful regional carriers, you know, of course, emerged to form Republic or what have you. But there were a ton of these, you know, little guys and run from very good to very awful, depending on which ones. But I read in the book, your wife flew for Braniff.
She did. Yeah.
What years was she flying?
She flew from 64 to 67. She'd been with him 3 years when we got married.
Oh, wow.
I know you enjoyed the romantic story of how we met.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Exactly. She was dating your buddy. But
yeah. Yeah, but, well, now you make me sound like a bum.
No. They broke up long before that. Okay.
That's right.
That's right. Many cities and many miles between them. Yeah,
and I didn't have a clue, but she had her sights set on me from way back, and I just didn't have a chance. Anyway, one of the fun stories. I don't know if you caught it or not, but when I was invited to go out to San Diego to interview with Pacific Southwest Airlines.
Oh yes,
you remember that little story?
Yes.
Part of the interview. I had a friend, my roommate from Vietnam, got home early, and he got with PSA. And so after Delta originally turned me down, so I kept, you know, going for airlines, and PSA sent me a telegram, said, if you can get yourself out here, we'll interview you. And they did, and everything went very well. The last part of the interview, Don Dolan, who was there, chief pilot, took me down into the 737 simulator. I'd never flown a 737, but most transport jets are about the same. So we flew it, and that went well. And as we walked out of the building, this bus drove up. It was a crew bus. And I don't know if you remember about PSA, but they used to hire would-be movie starlets back in the day for their flight attendants. I mean, they were just so about 20 of those movie starlets in hot pants got out of that bus. And we were talking, and Mr. Dolan said, well, Mike, he said, we'd like to have you. He said, do you want to come to work for us? I said, yes. He said, well, I'm sure. He said, let me go up and talk with the gentleman up there. He hired me on the spot, which was pretty nice.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, when you go up there, you tell those guys, if they don't want to hire me as a pilot, could I please drive that bus?
Yeah.
He slapped me on the back. He said, yeah, you're a pilot.
That's wonderful. So if Sheila, your wife, went to Braniff in 64, that was probably about the time that Great America bought them and National Car Rental.
I don't remember that. I know that that was back in the time of the great Gucci uniforms and all those crazy psychedelic uniforms they had. The brand of flying colors. You remember that?
Oh my God! Funny you mentioned that, because when they came out with the colorful planes, they did a lot of press releases about that, about their 15 colors and their matching interiors. And they announced that Mary Wells came up with the design. And I thought, oh my God, I figured they meant the singer for Motown. And I'm like, geez, Mary Wells. Well, if they were going for Motown, I think Diana Ross might. And then somebody said, no, she's somebody who does this kind of stuff. But yeah, they did those nutso colors. But there again, at the same time, behind the scenes, that's about the time that Troy Post got that contract to do contract military transport from Vietnam to Hawaii. So I guess that was a certain amount of subsidization as well.
I suppose, I don't know, but I know that when I interviewed, Sheila warned me. She said, you don't want to go with Brent if they're not going to make it. So how she knew that, I don't know. But
well, it had a rocky history. I know in 67 they bought Panagra, which was how I knew them, because I used to spend time in La Paz, which is, on the Altiplano in Bolivia, the absolute worst place to land anything because of the...
I heard it was pretty tough. I never went down there.
Oh, yeah. And they had a state carrier, Lloyd Aereo Boliviano. Don't even start me. But I guess Braniff also, and this would have been, you were at Delta by then, weren't they the first domestic SST flight?
Yes. As a matter of fact, they used to fly the SST from Dallas. To DFW.
Right.
And it was Braniff pilots flying it over domestic routes. They flew subsonic. But, yeah, they sure did. That must have been a cool assignment.
That must have been. And I remember hearing something about that when they went from Dallas to Dulles, and then they changed the flight registration numbers with adhesive vinyl as it took off for Europe.
Oh, really? I never knew that.
Well, I guess...
You know more details about airline flying than I do, Raleigh.
Well, I doubt that's true, but I just remember some of those anecdotal stories, because I believe that it wasn't Braniff, it became Air France or British Air Crews that took it overseas. And I remember the time someone said, yeah, they even with adhesive changed the tail numbers. And so you would probably know a lot more about that than I would. And that's how Eastern bought their South American routes. And you're right. It was. But in terms of impacting you, I guess the first big one would have been the merger with Northeast, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that happened 27 months after I was hired. In fact, the month I got hired in July of 70, they should have furloughed us. They didn't have much for us to do for 2 years, Riley, and Delta was great about keeping us on. We'd go out twice a month and fly what they call extra crew member and keep our currency up, so we could handle the engineer panel. But when Northeast came in, that was a big boost to all of us. And it was a great merger. I fell in love with those people from the Northeast. There's something else. I remember one night we were flying with it. First time we ever flew with a Boston flight attendant crew. And the Delta girls, I mean, they're sweet. They're wonderful. I love them. But they weren't really, you know, lively like the Northeast people were. So this flight attendant came up, sat on the jump seat. Well, we're going to dinner tonight, boys. I said, what? And so she said, yeah, we, at Northeast, we do that. We go to dinner with the crews. But, yeah, I just fell in love with them. Good pilots, too. They were old school, some of those guys.
Well, I guess Howard Hughes had bought them, didn't he, like in 62? And I think he, I think he did. I think what happened was he was there like a New York minute because the CAB yanked the Miami route. And that was, and I guess they started out as a contract carrier for Pan Am, but I knew him because George B. Storer had bought him, and he owned a chain of radio stations. And the big joke was that George merged with Delta for less than the value of the hardware. I never knew if that was true or not, but it was certainly the crew's lucky days that Delta got him. That's for sure.
I think so. I'm going to tell you a little side story if you got a second for this.
Sure.
We had in our ground school, we had to have an instructor to keep us current on federal aviation regulations and instrument procedures and all that. And there was a lady from Northeast that we inherited. Her name was Pat Malone.
Oh, yeah.
Did you hear about Pat? Did I write about Pat?
You wrote about Pat extensively, and you even, and the poems. The poems are
Mother
amazing.
Malone. That's right. Well, Pat was, we were in class one day, and she had worked for TWA. She was a Link instructor, a flight simulator instructor for him. And she said one day this tall guy came in and said, I'd like you to give me a workout in the Link. She said, well, who are you? And she said, he couldn't produce any identification saying who he was and how he was connected. So he said, I'll be back in a minute. So in a couple of minutes, she got a call from the chief pilot of TWA and said, Pat, do the initials HRH mean anything to you? And she said, well, that's Howard Hughes' initials. She said, well, that's who that was down there, and he would like to get a ride in the Link with you. So he came back and he thanked her for protecting their assets, you know, and everything. And she said she gave him a big workout. And he sent her a gallon of Chanel No. 5 after that ride.
That's great.
I thought that was one of the greatest airline stories in the world. I love Pat. She was just amazing. But I thought you'd like to hear that story.
It's a wonderful story. I'm talking with Captain Mike Trahan, and you're welcome to join us. That's 312-981-7200. I'm Raleigh James, filling in for G, and this is WGN Radio.
Since that year ago, glad that you're still here, 'cause I love you so. One year ago today, yes, we made our vow. Your love, I'm glad to say, I've cherished up to now.
Mentioned that the Dells got their name from the Dell Satins got their name from the Dells and the Five Satins, and that is the Five Satins, group that had a big hit within the Still of the Night. Fred Paris and the Five Satins were probably the best thing ever to come out of New Haven. They were on Ember. It's 1957, wasn't charted. They weren't the only groups out of New Haven either, the Nutmegs, for instance, and everybody remembers in the Still of the Night, but most people remember To the Isle, but my all-time fave, our anniversary. I'm Raleigh James. I'm filling in for G, who is off for the holiday, but she will be back Monday, and next week is her last week. And after that, she joins News Nation, which debuts on WGN America on September 1st. So you can go to WGNAmerica.com and read all about it, and you should if you haven't already. You can also see some videos, and it's a great idea. Finally, news that isn't biased. What a concept. Yeah, it'll actually be news. All right, so I'm talking with Captain Mike Trahan, Air Force officer, Vietnam vet, and Delta Airlines, 32 years, retiring as a captain in 2002. And you're welcome to join us. I hope you will. 312-981-7200. You know, Mike, when you started flying for Delta 1970, we were still dressing up to get on planes. This was, you know, and I think now where they're the flying buses of the air, I mean, you experienced that by the time you were retiring. I can't imagine what changes you went through.
Well, yeah, and I remember back in the early years we were flying, and we said, you know, these are the golden years of airline flying, and by golly, they were, because they have changed radically since then. Of course, after 9/11, even more radically, you know, it just became so deadly serious and so tense for a long time. I think it's probably relaxed a little bit now. But, yeah, it was classy. People used to dress nice, and it was an adventure for them to go on an airplane.
Sure, and it was oh so civilized compared to some of the stories you hear today. Speaking of civilized, I meant to actually cart it and put it on the air. I heard this give and take with someone in ATC and a private pilot who flew into restricted space, and she told him to get out, and he said no. And it was about 3 minutes of he saying no, I'm not going, and. I'll try to find that and maybe send you that link, because it was one of those things where I thought to myself, yes, times have really changed. And now, are you still flying, not piloting, I know, but as far as flying as a passenger?
Oh, yeah. Every once in a while I'll hitch a ride with a friend's got an airplane. I've had a couple of health problems since we talked last. And I was grounded already, but I had a little blood clot behind my right eye, so I've lost vision in my right eye. I could fly. I could still fly. In fact, there was an airline pilot who had one eye, but he proved capable of flying with just one. I would not fly with passengers, as me being the only pilot on the plane, because I have no backup, you know, and I was born to have a backup.
But I would think that depth perception would become increasingly difficult.
This just happened a few months ago, and I haven't been up since, and I'm looking forward to trying that. I have a friend who has a Cessna, and we're going to go up and see how my depth perception is affected. I can tell, you know, when I try to put toothpaste on a toothbrush, it's different.
Yes. Exactly.
Probably. Yeah. I wanted to mention something. I was listening to your music coming in. With your love of history of music, I've got something I want to recommend for you.
Okay.
You ever heard of swamp pop music, S-W-A-M-P?
Sure.
You have?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. Well, down where I grew up in Orange, Texas, we had a nightclub right across the river in Louisiana, and you could go over there and drink and dance at age of 18 in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And they had local bands, and those guys that started back then became legends in Louisiana, and we're all the same age. They were all high school guys, you know, when they were starting out. Now they're in their mid to late 70s, and they're still making music down there. But it was really fun. It was a lot of fun to dance to that music. I just wondered if you had learned anything about that. You know everything else about it.
So. Well, you know, I mean, this started really in the 50s, and you're right. It was an amalgamation in Louisiana, and they had ballads too. They weren't all up tempo. Like Cookie and the Cupcakes had Matilda, which was
that was the theme song.
Yeah, right. Everybody knows Matilda, and that was on Paula, which was a great little label out of Shreveport. And Bobby Charles, See You Later, Alligator, and Bill Haley covered that later. But you know, I guess you could even Phil Phillips, Sea of Love. What?
Raleigh?
Yes.
What was our national theme song for Christmas in the Swamp Pop era?
What?
Won't you come home for Christmas? Oh. Bells will be ringing. Charles, you remember that song?
Well, I know the Charles Brown version of it.
That's it. That's
okay.
It. And
okay.
It became an instant hit, so much so that every year we had a contest. Whoever heard Bells Will Be Ringing first would note the time and call all their friends and say, I heard it today. Christmas is on. So that's kind of neat. It, music played a big part in our lives back then. But
yeah.
Anyway, I digress, as they say.
No, that's great. Well, Charles Brown was, I guess he was from Texas City and then Galveston area. And, he had been in L.A., and I always thought of more of as an L.A. guy because he relocated there early and did a lot of stuff there. But yeah, Please Come Home for Christmas is huge. I still hear that today. But then you have the arguments, would you consider Jimmy Clanton to be swamp pop? I don't know that I'd go that far.
I think he was from Baton Rouge, Jimmy was, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Listen, one of the guys that played in that Big Oak Club that I was telling you about was Bobby Kimball, and Bobby went on to Toto, and he's featured in Rosanna, and there was another in Africa. His voice is featured in those two songs, so he hit it big. Yeah,
sure.
Some of those guys did real good.
Yeah, and he was. I think he was from Vinton.
He was.
And
absolutely.
So
yes.
I'd remembered that on some little story they have. But wasn't he did something with part of the Three Dog Night? I think they had a gig out in L.A. They formed a group.
I lost track until somebody told me that it was him with Toto. But
yeah. No, they had some. I thought Hold the Line was just one of the best songs by Toto. And I think that was before Rosanna and Africa. Absolutely. And I think New Orleans is such a huge contributor to both soul, you know, R&B and pop, really. And but that's another place. I guess spoken like an old person. When I used to go to Louisiana, especially New Orleans, this was a great city. The percentage of black home ownership was very high. There was a vibrant black middle class of people. You had a lot of great areas, and you know, not only the tourist stuffs like the Vocal Ray, but a lot of great areas. And now, and I'm not even talking about post-Katrina, but even before that, it just like disintegrated. And I don't know what happened to New Orleans.
Well, I think the tornadoes and the floods, I mean, the hurricanes and the floods and all that started it. But yeah, you're right, it's changed a lot down there.
Yeah, it just used to be a robust city. And,
the area that really brought swamp pop alive was what they call her Acadiana. It's west of the Mississippi River, actually west of the Shafalaya Swamp, starting around New Iberia and Lafayette and all those places, and down through there. And that's where they really, that stuff developed. And then they had Zydeco music and Cajun music. I'm 99% Cajun by heritage.
Wow, that's great.
And I'm Texan by birth. So, yeah.
Well, I think one of my favorites, and it's not known that well, I've played it before as a bumper, but is Charles Sheffield, It's Your Voodoo Working. And when I
don't remember that.
Oh,
spot.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just a we're talking with Mike Trahan, Captain Trahan, and should you want to join us, obviously, topics, whatever is on your mind will be on ours. 312-981-7200. I'm Raleigh James, in for G on WGN Radio.
In the palm of my hand, and I told them, thought to can sink. You know what I mean. I know you've heard that the woman
got to treat her like,
soon take advantage
like,
of you.
Got to treat her like,
let me tell you,
treat her like,
my friend,
got to treat her like,
I just ain't
worth
it to
got to treat her like,
you oughta
treat her like
the lady.
Got to treat her like, treat her
the best you can.
Apologies for that. I pulled it off a CD. Shouldn't have done that. It is not the original 45 mix. It is the first hit for Cornelius Brothers and Baby Sister Rose, Treat Her Like a Lady, on United Artists in 1971. Got to number 20 on the R&B charts, peaked at number 3 on the pop charts 49 years ago today, which is why I played it, because that was the first record they had released, and it was the peak of the charts 49 years ago right now. They're from Miami area. They recorded at Bob Archibald Music Factory, which really was a factory. It was in the Garment District on 27th Avenue and 5th Street. Now, off the strength of how well Bob Archibald did with the Cornelius Brothers, the Music Factory by the end of the 70s was 32 track, and at 5,000 square feet, it was quite the thing. But what started it all was that, Treat Her Like a Lady. I'm Raleigh James. It's WGN Radio. I'm filling in for G. She will be back all next week for her final week, and then you will see or hear her or be aware of her on News Nation. Go to Jesus, it just chokes me up, obviously. I made the mistake of eating something during the last break, and you can tell it, can't you? WGNAmerica.com. There you go. Or if you're on Facebook, News Nation Now. And we're talking with Captain Mike Trahan about this and that. Really, that's the easiest way to say it, but it's perfect for Independence Day with your Air Force career and being a Vietnam vet. And we actually got a caller, Bob in Indiana. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Hello, Miss James.
Hi, Bob.
I have to tell you straight up that I am so appreciative every time you're on this radio station because I lock in.
Aren't you kind?
You.
And we didn't even have to pay you for that. That's just so nice.
I'll take whatever money you want to throw this way.
Yeah, right. Well, both dimes, okay.
Yeah, but I absolutely love your bumper music, and I love your program. And please find a way just to get on GN, because
it would
be a massive improvement.
Oh no! Well, I'll tell you, I agreed to do at least temporarily for July and August the rest of this show after next week when G leaves, and then we'll see.
God.
We'll see what happens if I'm still alive after that, because I still have a few radio stations I own and all this other stuff that I do. In fact, when I stop doing afternoon news somewhere, I have like 4 minutes before the WGN show starts. So yeah.
Well, again, thank God.
Oh, aren't you kind? Well, now, I you have to do your part, though, Bob. I expect you to call regularly.
Well, I try.
Okay.
Okay, and also, please, pass on the cap. I remember Spooky.
All right.
Do. Yeah, I remember Spooky, and I also remember in 86... the last commercial DC-3 I saw in the States.
Ooh.
Used to fly in regularly to Key West. I believe it was PBA.
Goodness gracious.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was like walking into Casablanca. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
So, but again, Cap, thank you. And there, and you done it.
All right, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Wow.
That's nice. Yeah, that's really nice. Yeah, the DC-3s were just terrific. I mean, not that I'd want to be a passenger on one now necessarily, but they were a workhorse for literally decades.
Hey, Dr. Raleigh, that airplane has been with me my entire life. You said you haven't gotten into the first book, The Civilian Years.
Yeah.
You'll get to a part where right after I graduated college, when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I always go backwards, but when I was about 10 or 11 years old, we lived on a little farm in Orange, Texas, and it was not far from the local airport, and a millionaire owned the airport, and the millionaire owned the DC-3 that he flew out of that airport, and I used to lay in the pasture with my old dog Goober and watch that big airplane fly over, wondering what it would be like to fly something like that. Well, gosh, 10 years later, when I was about 20, 21, 22, I got to fly that very airplane. And then later on, wound up flying the Spooky. But there's a great story about how Mr. Brown let me fly co-pilot for him, flew out to his ranch in Kerrville, Texas, and spent a wonderful week out there. You'll enjoy that story. But the airplane was spectacular.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
He could have afforded a Learjet. They brought one in to Orange and said, let's go fly. And Mr. Brown got on the airplane and he said, I can't walk around with my bourbon in my hand on this airplane. I just stick with my DC-3.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he could have bought anything anyway. Well, I wonder how that guy knew about Spooky. That's interesting.
Well, maybe he was listening before, or after all, I mean, Spooky, yes, you've told the story, but it is a legend.
Well, and thanks to you, I think my goal in life now is to perpetuate that legend. I just learned the other day that they've retired the last AC-130 from the 4th really? Operations Squadron, and that was really? The last one to use our call sign, Spooky, modern 130 gunships. And I was saddened by that, but I think they'll reconstitute the squadron again someday and hope they'll use Spooky again. But we started the program. Our little airplane proved that it was feasible, and the AC-119 came along and said you can do it even a little better, and then the 130 came, and that was the perfect airplane.
But, yeah. Now, I know you touched on it a little in your Delta career and probably maybe even in other flying career, but I got to ask about it. UFOs.
I knew you were going to do that to me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't care. I've seen them.
All right.
I'll take whatever I'm 78 years old. I don't care. Bring it on, buddy. One night we were flying from Atlanta, Jackson to Shreveport, going right over Monroe, Louisiana, and something caught the corner of my eye, and it went across right in front of us, horizontal. It was level. It wasn't climbing or descending or anything, and it had a mass. It looked like just a lump of something, and it went by so fast. It crossed the windscreen in about 2 seconds. From one end to the other, and. Just a quick calculation told me it was going better than 2,000 miles an hour.
Wow!
And thinking that I was just seeing things, I just kind of didn't say anything. And then somebody came on the radio and said, "There's a little Cessna down below us." He said, I don't know what center it was, but it, whatever the control was, it said, yeah. "Do you have any fighter jets up tonight?" I said, "No." He said. We said, well, one of them just went by me going 500 miles an hour. And I said, no, try 2,000. Who said that? I didn't say another word.
No,
you know?
That's great.
I can't help but think, I can't help but think they're out there. And I did. I looked hard my whole career. In fact, after Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and I used to go out in the pasture and whistle that tune, hoping they'd come land, give me a ride.
What a great story, and that's a fine place to leave it, because you see that's an entree for another visit with you in the future, Captain
Robert,
Mike Trahan. I hope you'll join us again.
Anytime. I just love talking with you. Really
Thanks.
Do.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.